Last week, I went to a nice cafe with a number of sidewalk tables where attractive young people sit and talk. Not yet knowing the customs of Mexican cafes, I looked for someone to tell me whether I should find a table or order at the counter. I approached the barista, a well-dressed man standing behind the espresso machine. At the instant I began to speak in Spanish, my mouth filled with sawdust. With a thick accent, I said something like, "Is this where I order you to make me coffee?" He looked nonplussed, and a sour shame made me dizzy. He told me I needed to make my requests from a waiter. I found a table and sat down. Though I once spoke Spanish well, I've found that it's returning in fits and starts. Often I feel my tongue turn into a fat toad squatting in my mouth, clumsy and awkward, so that I sound at best like a small child, at worst like an imperious tourist. But this has also forced me to recognize the perils of communication more broadly. How can I convey the raw difference of daily life in Cuernavaca from my life back home satisfactorily? How can I write to my mother in Minnesota without flattening my experience, so that it's not simply that I live where the days are warmer and the tacos cheaper, but that the air I breathe, and the looks I get, and the streets I walk emerge from different complex histories, a world of difference? Let me try a different tack. On Sunday, I attended a book festival in the nearby town of Tepoztlan, celebrating the literary connection between Canada and Mexico. Six panelists were asked to speak on the topic of the elusive truth in journalism and fiction. Truth, as always, was an unwieldy concept, and in one case it stirred angry passions. Mexican writer Hugo Iriarte attempted to get at the complexity of truth by noting how Kafka and Jesus both answered questions by telling stories and speaking or writing in parables. At this, a portly man with a gray goatee sitting in the row ahead of me leapt to his feet and interrupted Iriarte. He demanded in English for the panelists to describe the difference between history and fiction. Then, switching to Spanish, he berated Iriarte for claiming that Jesus talked about history and bellowed for all to hear that the eminent panelist knew nothing about the Bible. The confusion began because of the Spanish word historia, which means both story and history. Where I heard Iriarte say that Jesus told stories, the man in front of me heard that Jesus told histories. But even if inaccurate, why would it infuriate the man in the goatee? The answer, I think, is in the man's first question and goes to the heart of the event itself and speaks, ultimately, to the problem of communicating my experience abroad. I think the angry goateed man wanted the panelists to say that history is the realm of facts while fiction is free to do with facts as it pleases. And, in fact, the panelists spent most of the discussion circling around this very question, arguing that journalism works with the truth of facts while fiction engages some kind of truth beyond facts. I happen to think the picture is blurrier than this. And it brought to mind how I'd once learned about the history of the concept of truth itself. One of the tricky things about truth is that the word carries within it a long history that we can't sum up in a phrase. For a long time, perhaps since Plato, a principal sense of truth has been the correspondence of statements to reality. Like if I say, the First World War started on the 28th of July, 1914, that statement is true if it corresponds to the reality of history. This is largely what we mean when we talk about facts. Is it true? Does it correspond to reality? On the other hand, a leading 20th century philosopher, Martin Heidegger, harkened back to an even earlier sense of truth, or even the grounding for the possibility of truth, which he found in the Greek word aletheia. Heidegger argued that aletheia is truth as the revelation of a world, an unveiling, a shining forth. In this sense, truth has nothing to do with facts and language isn't about correspondence. Rather, true language or sculpture or painting opens the world to us. Back at the book festival, Iriarte made a case for the purpose of fiction. He argued that the world in which we live is cruel, chaotic, and horrible, and that fiction provides us a less chaotic, more orderly version of the world in which we might find some solace. His statement resonated with me as a description of the festival itself. Within the walls of this literary club, people appeared well-dressed and healthy, lawns green and manicured, the day arranged according to a printed schedule. Life outside was much more raw. People jostled through bustling markets of fruit, strawberries stacked in toppling pyramids. Sad clowns squeezed their red plastic noses. New Agers flocked to breathe the spirit of the Aztec god Quetzalcoatl. Locals gathered to protest the government's plan to build a new highway through the middle of town. A legless old woman with a chiseled face begged for change. No one mentioned, with regards to truth, the novelist Malcolm Lowry, who lived most of the last years of his life in Mexico and Canada, and whose novel, Under the Volcano, is the greatest work written about Cuernavaca. Against Iriart, Lowry's novel often pours out visions of the world's chaotic cruelty. It is the story of an alcoholic diplomat battling his drunkenness hopelessly toward his doom. It recounts the suffering of the diplomat among others on the streets of Cuernavaca. Yet its moments of solace strike me as flickers of aletheia, as a shining forth. Listen to Lowry's diplomat remember a moment from his youth. He writes, "The seagull, pure scavenger of the Empyrean, hunter of edible stars. I rescued that day as a boy when it was caught in a fence on the cliffside and was beating itself to death, blinded by snow. And though it attacked me, I drew it out unharmed, with one hand by its feet, and for one magnificent moment held it up in the sunlight, before it soared away on angelic wings over the freezing estuary." Lowry's seagull, I believe, is experience itself, a fleeting thing once grasped, a hunter of edible stars, drawn out by tenderness. Difficult to look at, difficult to hold, soaring away from us. Lowry reveals a world, our world, at once the same for each of us and yet different. The world that I am trying to grasp here with my hopelessly inadequate words, the aletheia that I seek to express, always soars from me, however much I hasten in pursuit.